Good morning, everyone. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski with Children Come First, and we're here every week. We'd like to introduce today our special guest. As you know, we're always inquiring about children and their needs, and this one is a little twist on our usual topics, and today we're going to be speaking with Tom Gensel. Tom is the Assistant Executive Director of all things, the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Daria.
Tom, we're going to talk today about this elusive entity called a school board, so I'm hoping you're going to be able to help us, because sometimes I'm not sure that I can figure out what exactly the function of each level of education is, so I'm hoping you're going to help us on this level.
Happy to try.
How long have you been with the School Board Association?
Almost 20 years. This summer it'll be 20 years.
You've been with the School Boards Association for 20 years.
I know. Honestly, it does not seem possible. Time really does fly, I guess, when you enjoy what you're doing.
Wow. And you look young for your age, then.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Tom, let's talk a little bit about the functions of school boards. What is the function of the association itself? Let's start with that.
Well, we are a private nonprofit organization. We're not related to state government, so we are an organization that really consists of the local school boards throughout the state. They voluntarily join our organization, and we in turn provide information, publications, various services, including management services and insurance services, customized workshops, as well as the advocacy work that we do at the state and federal levels. That's actually the area that I'm responsible for.
And what do you advocate for?
Well, really, we see our role as being representing the public's interest in this process. Board members are elected locally. They are the public's representative in this process for setting policy and overseeing the operation of schools. And those local board members establish a platform and adopt positions that they think are needed to improve public education. And I guess, Daria, I would draw a distinction between our organization and many of the others that do good work in the education system, but whose function is really quite different. When we advocate at the state level, for example, before the General Assembly, it's not for the personal benefit of our members. We're not advocating new benefits for them. We're advocating legislation that they think we needed to help improve education, and for example, funding and changing the system for funding special education is one of our big issues right now. So that's not something that benefits our members personally, but it's something that they think is important to improve education.
All right, now let's take a look at school boards themselves. What is the function of a school board? There are so many hierarchies in the educational process that I can't. Can you relate it to business?
Sure.
In any way?
Well, in a way, the school board is the board of directors. Literally, that's what it's called in the school code of the school district. Their responsibility. All but one of the 501 school boards in the state are elected. Philadelphia is the one exception, and there the board is appointed by the mayor. But in all the other districts, it's an elected board of the community, and their job really is to establish policy and oversee the operation of the schools in their district. Obviously, much of what public schools do is regulated in some way by the state or federal governments or various court decisions, but there's still a lot of room for local decision-making and local control, and in that role, the board members are the elected representatives of the community. And I would add that they are not compensated. I think one of the real wonderful things about our system of governance is that we have these 4,500 local officials, nine on each of 501 school boards, who serve without pay and who devote enormous amount of time and energy to providing that direction for public schools. It's not an easy job, obviously, but it's, I think, a great example of community service.
All right. Now, the school board itself, So we have the, I'm going to assume an ideal here. We have the superintendent who does, works on the day-to-day operations of the district and deals with litigation and, you know, the community and things of that nature. And I'm assuming oversees hiring and firing of personnel. What function does the school board have?
First of all, the board, of course, hires the superintendent. Probably the single most important thing that a board does is to hire the right educational leader. The superintendent, by the way, is obviously not a voting member of the board, but is a member of the board by law. Is kind of considered the 10th non-voting member of the board. So it's an active partner with the school board in managing the district. The district has a number of enumerated duties. It has to approve textbooks. It actually does the official hiring of teachers, although in most districts the screening and recruitment and so forth, the recommendations come from the administration. They adopt the budget, set the tax levies, and provide policy direction. One of the roles of a school board is to enact policy, which is kind of the equivalent of a school law, if you will, like that directs how things would be done in a school district. And those policies then in turn are implemented by the administrators.
Now, I have a question to ask only because I've been in business for many years. And I'm sort of playing the devil's advocate here. You'll have to excuse me. But you said that school boards hire teachers. Now, I've been on boards, and I've been, not school boards, but I've been on business boards, and I have a board myself. And our board would not ever be involved in the hiring of personnel. Why are school boards hiring teachers?
On one level, I guess the answer is because the school code requires that, but also because there is a form of accountability back to the public. I mean, unlike a corporate board, we're talking about spending tax dollars. Now, I think the bigger issue that you're raising, though, is at what level of detail should a school board be operating? School districts tend to be fairly large operations. In many communities in this state, particularly in rural areas, the school district is one of the largest employers in the area. So it would probably not be possible or certainly appropriate for a school board to be micromanaging all the daily operations of a district. That's why you hire good administrators, you establish policy and expectations, and you hold them accountable for implementing it. One of the most important duties, I think, of a school board is to say, as representatives of the public in the community, the parents, the taxpayers, business interests, and others, here's the direction we want to move this school district, and to be, if you will, looking beyond the dashboard down the road and trying to move the district in that direction. So they have responsibility for making sure that the laws are being complied with, that the programs are being implemented, procedures are being followed. But their duties, obviously, are not to do those things themselves. They're not expected to. They are volunteers, but they have responsibility for ensuring that those things all happen.
Well, I guess I have to give you a little bit of impetus, information on why I asked you that question, and that was that I noticed that the new regulations that were, I believe, put out last year were directly relational to something called nepotism, which, frankly, I haven't heard in a very long time. I was working out of Virginia for a long time and have come back to Pennsylvania. And when I went around to the different school boards and observed school board meetings, I noted that I observed it, for example, in one school district where they were hiring teachers, and they had three applications, and I noted that one of them had tremendous qualifications and was from another state. And yet they hired the person who was in their own backyard and, frankly speaking, was related to one of the school board members. So it left an impression on me, and I considered this kind of a micromanaging that probably is something that might be addressed in terms of what school boards do. And am I incorrect in that assumption?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say as a general rule, and I get around to many of the districts in the state, that boards, you know, hire their own relatives. I mean, as a matter of fact, in most districts, the process for reviewing and screening applicants, as I indicated before, comes through the administrators. But let me just say a couple other things. One is that a lot of districts, and I've lived in some of these areas, are very small rural areas, and the issue of nepotism is kind of an interesting one, because if you said you couldn't hire a relative of a board member, I've literally lived in towns where I think everybody was related to each other. It'd be very difficult to untangle that. The other is that when we look at new teachers, for example, what we found, and we've surveyed school districts on this subject, we find that oftentimes they do tend to be more comfortable with local people, if you will, and often it's because these are teachers who have done their student teaching there that are known to them. It's a known quantity. I think the point is well made, and we have talked with our members about looking at casting the net widely and bringing in folks to teaching positions who come from a variety of schools, not just the nearby state school, but perhaps some private colleges, and so that you build a teaching force that reflects sort of a range of philosophies, if you will, not just the philosophy of the faculty at the college down the street. And I think a lot of districts try to do that, but how they do it, again, and the procedures they go through is really a matter of local control. There really isn't much state regulation about how a district hires teacher. We have, as I think every state does, we have requirements that teachers in the public schools hold state certificates, and a state certificate is it's really a declaration that individual is qualified to teach. So we've already gotten past the issue of whether or not the person is qualified. If they hold the certificate, they're considered qualified. It's up to the district to say who's the best fit for our program. And sometimes it's not necessarily the teacher that had the straight A's in college. I mean, if you look at a new teacher, or a student teacher who is very effective in the classroom but had a B average in college, sometimes that can be more important if they're able to reach the students and actually help them to learn.
Well, you had addressed the next question that I was about to ask you, which was that, when you tend to hire locally, the bank of information, new information that's coming in, and the kinds of diversity that we're looking for and new ideas doesn't always exist when you hire people locally. It's a good policy, and we also need to expand our horizons as well.
Yeah, I might say, just on that point, I think this is probably human nature as much as anything else, but when we've asked the question, not just of school board members, by the way, this was a question we asked of superintendents as well and school administrators, which colleges do the best job of preparing new teachers? Inevitably what we saw was they primarily listed the nearby schools. And when we looked into that a little further, what we found was those were the colleges they knew best. They worked with the education faculty at those schools. They had the student teachers that came out of those programs, and they had a comfort level with them. So it's kind of understandable how people would have that frame of reference, but I think the point's well made. Districts have large pools of applications in this state for teachers, which is not a luxury that some other states have right now. California is pretty much at a point, I think, of just putting a warm body in the classroom.
In Florida as well.
Pennsylvania, we have a larger pool, and certainly, without getting into the whole teacher salary issue, I'll just say the salaries are not a problem. We know that people want to go into the classroom. So districts have the ability now to pick and choose perhaps a little more than they might have at one time.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Tom Gensel. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right.
Tom is the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. We're talking about school boards and their function. If you'd like information from Tom or the School Boards Association, you may call them at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can call us here at Children Come First at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PRO-KIDS. Now, Tom, why do we need people who don't have education backgrounds, who have basically gone through school themselves and have either gone into business or retired or done other things on school boards? Why do we need those kinds of people?
That's actually, I think, a great question, and it really is. It gets to the heart of what school boards are all about. I think the answer in a sentence or two is that we want a cross-section of the community making policy. That's the local ownership in the education process. We hire education experts to be our administrators and our teachers and to actually deliver the educational program. But the policy setting really needs to come from the community, which is paying for this after all. So a school board that includes some parents, some business officials, some blue-collar workers, folks, retirees, people who don't have kids in school, a good cross-section of the community, when they can act as representatives of the public and say, here's the priority, here's the programs we're going to fund, here's the budget we're going to adopt, they can speak a little bit more for the community that again, is supporting the decision.
So you are now not a governmental agency. You are a nonprofit agency, the Pennsylvania School Boards Association.
Nonprofit association, that's right.
And you give information to school boards.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you have a source for disseminating that information?
Yeah, actually, we produce a number of publications, a weekly magazine that contains a lot of reports on what's happening in Harrisburg and around the country, a bi-monthly magazine, other specialized newsletters. I would also say we have a website that we're very proud of, and we encourage all of your listeners to visit. That's www.psba.org. That would also, I think, give you a flavor of a number of the things we do. We also provide, and I would want to make sure I emphasize this, an awful lot of in-service programs for our members, because we recognize really two things. One, that our members are generally not experts in education, although we do have some, obviously. Most of them don't have a background in education or in budgeting and finance and a lot of the other areas that school boards deal with. So they attend our programs, and we're very proud of the high level of participation and really the high quality of the programs we put on. The other thing we know, and this is important to point out, Daria, is that there's a high level of turnover on school boards. The average school director in this state serves only about 4 years, or about one term. And I don't know about you, but that's almost scary to me, because there's a lot of upheaval that we see through this process, and it's very difficult to sustain a long-term vision for an organization, a school district, or any group where you have that kind of turnover on boards.
Are you suggesting that they stay in for longer periods?
Well, what I'm saying is that back in the late 70s, the law was changed. We used to have 6-year term for board members, and what that meant was every 2 years, every odd-numbered year, three members of a school board would be up for election. And if there was turnover, it tended to happen in not quite as dramatic a way. Or, you know, you certainly rarely saw a majority of the board sort of just shifting. We changed to a 4-year term, and now it's a 5-4 rotation. Every other year, either 5 or 4 seats are up. And in some cases, with vacancies to be filled and so forth, we've seen 6, 7, 8 seats up in one election. And I certainly think it's important that, you know, if the public doesn't want these people on a school board, that they're able to replace them. All I'm saying is that when you have these large turnovers and you see the average length of service on a board, that's really the bigger issue as far as I'm concerned. The average length of service is down to around 4 years. Many of our members, as we do our training programs and talk with them, will say that, you know, if you're just elected to a school board, it takes you a year or two before you're really pretty comfortable with the terms and, you know, the requirements of law and so forth. It's a complex business. And when the average person's out of office after 4 years, we're always starting over with a new group. That's why I think the in-service programs, the publications, the resources we make available to school districts are so important, because they need to learn as much as they can, as quickly as they can.
Isn't there a way to make it so that it's, you know, only, well, let's see, 9 divided by 4, isn't it possible for every year only to have 2?
Well, this gets into a larger area of law, which is that the election laws in this state have always put local elections, not just school districts, but municipal county elections, in the odd-numbered years. And state-related offices, the General Assembly and Governor and Treasurer and Auditor General, for example, in the even-numbered years. So it would be kind of a huge mountain to move. And I don't know if there's an easy answer to it, but I think people need to understand that we're dealing with that issue as well. And I can also say that there's really a very high level of commitment and quality that we see on local boards. People run for school boards. You'll run into people occasionally that ran because they have one single issue kind of thing that was bothering them. But most people run because they really have a genuine concern about the schools in their community. They want to do the right thing, and they volunteer. They're not paid for it, but they step forward. And I think everything we can do to make that job easier for them and to give them the information they need is helpful.
Now, what kinds of services do you give to school boards? You do in-service training. Mm-hmm. You have media support. You were talking earlier about changing legislation. Now, I know from having spoken to legislators and to, especially to legislators, that they are inundated by all the special interest groups that come and speak to them about all the different kinds of, as a matter of fact, I was on the phone with one this morning who said his head was spinning because there were all these legislative issues to vote on this week, and he just couldn't make up his mind. You know, he'd had to delve into some in depth, and they are just inundated with reports and, you know, special interest group and lobbyists and et cetera. How do you fare in all of this?
Well, you know, I go back, first of all, to what I was saying before. We are not like many of the other groups that lobby, and I don't mean to demean them at all. They all have a role to play, but we're not up there lobbying on behalf of school board members, in other words, to enhance them. But our agenda is really driven by these volunteers on boards who representing their community, saying here are the laws that we think need to be changed to improve public education. And I think most legislators understand that. We don't have, for example, the School Boards Association does not have a political action committee. We don't endorse candidates. My staff and I do not wine and dine legislators. We don't take them out to dinner and buy them drinks. We don't do that kind of thing. Our lobbying is strictly informational lobbying, and I think where we've been very effective is establishing ourselves as a good, reliable, fairly impartial source of information that people can count on. We provide a lot of data to legislators at their request, and we comment on bills that are coming up to help them understand the effect locally. The other major thing we do, and again, have become pretty effective at this, is to provide the means for our local members, the officials sitting on school boards, to actually be talking to and working with legislators. And that's really critical when you think about it, because you have these local elected officials on school boards talking with state elected officials who are trying to get their decisions about policy and direction for education in sync so that we're all pulling in the same direction. And that's really critical. And I think we've been pretty effective at doing that.
How are you funded?
We're funded by the school district, so they pay dues to us for kind of part of our budget. And the services that we provide, for example, the in-service programs I was talking about, we do work with school districts on, for example, on policy service, helping them to write their policies. Those kinds of services we charge the districts that actually use them. So the ones that are interested in having PSBA help them catalog and write their policies and help them update policies as new laws and court decisions come out, which is one of the things we've done for years, would pay for that service. But it's a voluntary membership organization, and we're very proud of the fact that we've had virtually 100% membership, you know, throughout really all of our existence.
So now comes to the critical point of you've got 15 school districts, school boards, who are vying for your attention for you to go to legislators. And each one of them has a different issue on their agenda, and some of them may be contradictory. How do you pick which one you which position you take?
Yeah, you know, it's a very diverse state. I spend a lot of time on the road, and I'm often reminded of that. We have some of the very wealthiest communities in the entire country within our state, and some of the very, very poorest in the largest cities and very rural areas. We started something over 15 years ago, almost 16 years ago now, called a Legislative Action Program, and the whole point of it was to, after we've adopted our platform, which all boards participate in, and we have probably 100 items in that platform talking about things like funding and curriculum and collective bargaining and, you know, school construction, you name it. So we have positions that the boards themselves adopt. That's the one part of the answer to your question. We're guided by our own members' positions. We certainly don't make them up here. But the other thing we've done for the last 16 years is we go back out on the road and we go to county level meetings with board members and we say, look, here's the entire platform you've just adopted. Give us some input on what you think are the top two or three most important issues that we should really focus our efforts primarily on. And I remember when we started that 16 years ago, some people said, you know, you guys are crazy because you're going to have the rural districts at the throat of the urban districts and vice versa because everybody's going to have different priorities. Has never happened, never once. And as a matter of fact, what we've seen year after year after year is a real consensus that we're able to build through all these discussions. And, of course, it takes a lot of time and a lot of listening and getting people to kind of understand the options. But what we've done is we've managed to come to consensus and have boards across this state working together on a lot of things. And I think with some success, we had, for example, legislation that revised the collective bargaining law in this state that we really took the lead on getting passed a number of years ago, changes in sabbatical leave and tenure law, changes in funding and so forth that our members really came together on and we're working very closely together and often with other organizations too.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here every Tuesday. Today we're here with Tom Gentzel. He is the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. If you'd like to reach him, you can phone him at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can reach him on the website. You can reach the website at www.psba.org. That stands for Pennsylvania, I'm sure, School Boards Association.
Right.
www.psba.org. Or if you'd like to reach us with any questions or copies of our programs, you may call us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Or you may email us at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids, PROKIDS, at rlc.net. We're going to take a few minutes here, and we're going to acknowledge our sponsors. And we'll be back for our second half hour with Tom Gentzel talking about school boards, their functions, and where we go from here for the 21st century. So please join us for our second half hour. Again, if you'd like to call us, it's 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. And we'll be back in a few moments. guest today, who is Tom Gensel, the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. And Tom, we were talking about school boards and their functions and their diversification. And I asked you what happens when they come to you with differing opinions about the kind of legislation, because the state is so diversified. And I think what basically, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I heard you to say was that school boards tend to be in agreement on the kinds of issues that they want to deal with.
Well, that's certainly true. When you think about it, we've talked about this often within our membership. Take an issue like school safety, which is very much a concern of everybody. Now, how that issue plays itself out in an urban district might be quite different, and the nature of the school violence, for example, might be different in an urban area than in a rural area. What we found is they have a common concern about that. What we do is address the common concern, and we also work with the rural districts and urban districts, or even smaller groupings than that, if they have a particular need or problem that's facing them. We try to serve all of our members' needs as best we can. But I'm really impressed by how much consensus and agreement there is, because I think it says a lot about the fact that as diversified a state as we live in, we really have much more in common that really separates us.
Well, could you give us some of the major concerns that school boards have? I mean, you stated one, which is the obvious, which is school violence, but what other common concerns?
Well, let me give you the official priorities that were just selected recently by through this grassroots process that I was talking about. Two of them deal with funding. One deals with the general system of funding education in this state, which is, crying out for comprehensive reform. Your listeners may know that there had been a court challenge to the funding system, and the court said that the current system is not unconstitutional. But the fact that it's not unconstitutional doesn't mean that it's working well. And I think our members believe, and certainly a lot of legislators believe, that the system is very much in need of fixing, and so that's why our school boards have selected that as one of the top issues. Another one related to that, and it may all sound like it runs together, I guess perhaps to some people, is the issue of funding special education. But that really is a unique problem, because these programs are for kids that have special needs, of course, and they tend to be very expensive programs. They're important programs, but they are expensive, and school districts are not being adequately funded at all. We have a funding system. I won't get into the details unless you want to, but the funding system we have for special ed assumes that all districts have the same percentage of kids who have disabilities. Of course, that's not true. The percentages of students with disabilities can vary pretty widely. And it also assumes that all of their programs cost exactly the same throughout the state, which is also kind of equally absurd. So a lot of districts are footing more and more of this bill through local property taxes, and particularly if you're a less wealthy district and you don't have the local resources, that is very hard. But it's hitting all districts of all descriptions. And the other major priority area for us right now is the whole question of state mandates, something our association really has taken the lead on for a number of years. Say we need to look at some of the things that drive the cost of education but don't necessarily improve their value, and to try to get some relief. And as I indicated before, we've had success in some of those areas. We're going to continue to work on that.
Now, how can we, you know, I hear what you're saying. Are we talking about funding problems at the state level, at the federal level, or at the local level?
Well, actually, good point. Our priorities are dealing with state legislation, so this particular process doesn't typically deal with federal laws. We do work with our national organization, the National School Boards Association, very closely on issues affecting schools that are brought up at the in Congress and in federal government someplace. But as you know, education is primarily a state responsibility, so most of the action that we really get involved in is at the state level. But some of our priorities deal with, a couple of years ago, we were talking about the need for changing the local tax system in the state, and we're still talking about that. It's not an official priority of this organization right now, but it's very much front and center as far as we're concerned, because we do have a system that is inequitable, relies too heavily on local property tax. But that really fits hand in glove with the issue of state funding. The reason we rely so heavily on local taxes, to be honest, is because state government isn't paying the amount that it should to support education, and that forces school boards, sort of the last rung on the ladder, I guess, to actually raise the taxes. And so we need to deal with the whole question of how we fund schools.
Now, this is a really complicated issue, this funding business, because, you know, by the time the federal government decides on laws and wants to start funding certain things, let's just say handicap legislation, by the time the money funnels down to the local school districts, it may be 2 years later.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And needs change very quickly. I mean, we talk about how diverse Pennsylvania is. We have some districts, for example, that are very rapidly growing in pupil population, enormous growth up in the Poconos and sort of along the eastern and southern borders of the state primarily, but there are certainly other pockets as well. Those districts are faced with enormous new costs year after year, putting up new school buildings, hiring new teachers, and their tax base may be expanding a little bit as new houses are built, but the tax revenue certainly doesn't keep up with the added cost. Other districts that are being confronted with, again, a great deal of poverty and very pretty weak local tax base. They don't have much ability to fund education on their own. They rely very heavily on state government for additional resources. And when the state isn't paying its fair share, it really hurts those districts dramatically. And you can kind of go down through a list of problems like that, all of which, it's kind of a mosaic. You step back a little bit, you start seeing the bigger picture, but it's really made up of a lot of unique local issues.
Explain to our audience what a Title I school is. What does that mean? That's a federal funding.
Federal funding, and it's generally disadvantaged students. I mean, one of the purposes of federal funding generally has been to direct resources to targeted audiences or of groups of students who might be at risk. And in this case, where there's high concentrations of poverty, you often have a lot of other problems at play. You tend to have social infrastructure that's not very strong and maybe a need for a lot of support for those kids if they're going to succeed in school. And so programs like that have been targeted to help those kinds of students. I would say that the state government has a broader funding responsibility. I mean, we see the Commonwealth paying all school districts some money, but generally the philosophy at work for years and years has been that the state government should pay relatively more to the poorer districts than to the wealthier districts, just to try to help equalize resources so that they're able to address those kinds of needs as well.
Hasn't Connecticut developed, or in several other states, an equity law, tax laws?
Well, really, most states, I think the vast majority of states by now, have had some kind of challenge to their funding system, and about half of them have succeeded. Half, if not, as I said, Pennsylvania's lawsuit was essentially thrown out by the courts, in part because Pennsylvania courts have never been as inclined to get into things like that. I mean, they've always tended to defer more than, let's say, the courts in New Jersey and some other states would. They've tended to defer more to the legislature as the policy-making body to do things. So unless there's something clearly and patently unconstitutional, then the Pennsylvania courts don't tend to get involved. But having said that, what we're seeing now is a lot of legislators stepping forward saying the system may not be unconstitutional, but it's not working well, and state government is not paying its fair share. Certainly our Commonwealth has some resources now, I think through some good financial management, and also through the good fortunes of a fairly strong economy. And a lot of legislators are saying this is the right time for us now to fix some of these problems.
I have a question about, you know, for example, there's a lot of things happening in this state that are, and we, because I came from Virginia, I'm able to compare and contrast many things. And one thing that I discovered was that in Luzerne County, there hasn't been a tax assessment in 40 years, which means that these senior citizens in these communities are paying taxes from a booming economy that existed 40 years ago. And how is that possible? And you know, what kinds of things can we do to change that?
Well, as I, you know, this goes right to the heart of the funding issue. As I said before, we tend to rely very heavily on the property tax to fund not only schools, but to fund municipal governments and counties and so forth. In part because, as I indicated, I don't think state government's paying its fair share. But what compounds the misery and really sort of pours salt in the wound, I guess, is that the assessments on which those property taxes are based are usually very inequitable, and you're putting your finger right on it, Daria. The Pennsylvania history of property assessment, I mean, by almost any measure, we've done probably about as bad a job as any state in the country of measuring the value of property and keeping it relatively balanced.
I'm glad you said that.
Changing values. Now, there's a downside to that. If you remember the property tax revolt in California back in the 70s, one of the reasons for that was they did a very good job of tracking increasing value of property. And taxes were going up pretty significantly just because property values were rising so quickly. And that can be obviously a problem, too, although we don't have that kind of market in most places in Pennsylvania. But I used to work years ago in county government as a county administrator, and one of the things I helped with were setting up the hearings for the assessment appeals. You know, I mean, you and I, let's say, owned houses next door to each other, and you were paying less than I am, and our houses were essentially built by the same person. They looked almost the same. I would go into the county and say, how come Daria is paying less than I am? And in a lot of counties in this state, they really don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's the records and the history and the system that's used to assess property has just not been very strong. I think it's real important that we do a better job of that, and we finally have some counties. I don't know, Luzerne, I think, was going through a reassessment, if I recall. And there are a number of other counties that had not reassessed. And literally, I can say generations with a plural. It had been maybe 50 years or more since they had a reassessment. It's almost unimaginable, but that's where we've been. And if people don't have confidence in the assessment system, I don't think our houses are assessed fairly or properly, then any tax increase is just going to be that much worse for me.
Well, I know that a relative of mine in Luzerne County pays more taxes than I did I lived in Albemarle County, which is the second wealthiest county in the nation. And my property was equitable, and they were paying at least four times more than I was.
Yeah, now everything is kind of relative because there are also certainly examples where Pennsylvania property taxes can be much lower than some other neighboring areas. In fact, I've been in communities and I've talked to local taxpayer groups. I remember one in particular, I won't name the area, but virtually everybody that belonged to this taxpayer group in this school district in Pennsylvania had moved there from a neighboring state in part because the property taxes here were lower than they were in that other state, and they wanted to keep them low. That's why they formed a taxpayer group. But they all, you know, acknowledged to me that they moved here because property taxes generally tended to be lower. So things can, you know, you can kind of use anecdotal instances, I guess, to make the point. But we do know that property taxes certainly have a role in funding education. At least we believe they do. But when you rely as heavily as school boards have been forced to rely on property taxes, you put more and more of the burden on a limited group of taxpayers, those who own homes. And particularly if you're a senior citizen on fixed income, trying to maintain your own home, that can be a real burden, and that's something we're very concerned about.
Well, what is the alternative to it? Is there an alternative? I mean, what have other people done instead of, I know what we've done in Virginia, which is deplorable, and we're now doing away with it, which is car taxes. We pay literally the same real estate taxes on our car as people do on their homes, but what other kinds of alternatives are there to paying for our schools, especially in the second oldest state in the United States, meaning that there are more senior citizens here only equal to Florida?
That's right. Well, you know, it's a practical matter in our state, the array of taxes, because you're right, a number of states have those taxes on cars and so forth. I don't think Pennsylvania would ever pass something like the array of taxes we have available are property taxes, taxes on income, and historically we've only ever been able to tax earned income, meaning wages, not investment income. And so districts do have access to that right now, but on a very limited basis. And sales taxes at the state level. There have been some proposals for county sales taxes and allowing that money to be distributed among school districts and municipalities in a county. So if you have a mega mall, for example, that's located in one community that generates a lot of local, you know, that the argument for this tax, I'm not making it now, but just so you understand it, would be, well, that mall could generate a lot of sales tax revenue, which could be shared with a number of communities in that area rather than just that one community. But right now, we only have sales tax at the state level, with small exception out in the Allegheny County area. And there have been some efforts at tax reform. The legislature passed a local tax reform law a couple of years ago, but it was, from our members' perspective, fraught with all kinds of problems, and it was very complex. And if districts were to opt into this new plan under Act 50 of 1998, they had to do it one way and in a certain order. It didn't allow them to adapt it to meet local needs, so most districts have chosen not to implement that. I would say that we have to deal with the whole picture, though. We have to look at options to the property tax locally, but I'm going to sound like a broken record here. The property taxes are high because the state hasn't adequately funded education. I've always maintained one of the best forms of local tax relief that property owners could realize is for state government to, out of its larger tax base and through the state income tax, to pay a larger share of the cost of education. That would help school boards to reduce their reliance on property taxes dramatically.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski, and we're here today with Tom Gensel, who's the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. If you'd like to reach Tom, you can call him at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can reach the website at www.psba.org. That's www.psba.org. If you'd like to reach us here at Children Come First, you can call us at toll-free 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Tom, you know, there's been a lot of scuttlebutt about vouchers in this state, tuition vouchers to help parents and their children to have choices. It's ironic because when I spend a great deal of time in Harrisburg, as you know, and I listen to people talk about choice, and it's funny because I've spent 30 or 40 years researching educational models around the world, and my definition of choice and their definition of choice are very, very dramatically different. I had no idea what the conceptualization here in this state was of choice, and it had to do with vouchers, whereas in many other states, choice has to do with choosing curriculum that you want and, you know, teachers, etc. Tell us a little bit, what are your opinions about, will vouchers help, you know, for us to become a nation of corporate moguls running our schools?
Well, I need to make very clear, our members are strongly opposed to tuition vouchers. They think it would be a very bad public policy decision for several reasons. I mean, one is clearly it would drain money from public schools, and we'd be asking the taxpayers of this state to essentially fund two systems of education, one public and one private, one very heavily regulated, I would argue too regulated, the public schools, but the other not regulated at all. It would also completely entangle government.
By the way, that's a very good point I hadn't heard before.
You know, it's there's no question that that the rules are different. That this we're not. I often hear advocates of vouchers and talk with them quite a bit about, you know, how competition will help to improve the quality of education. Competition, I mean, you could go on and on about this, but competition certainly doesn't work if the rules are so vastly different that the non-public schools are playing by a completely set of different rules than the public schools do. If they don't have to take every student that walks through their door like we do. And by the way, I don't think that should ever change. I hope public schools are always required to take every student that walks in. But if any non-public school ever wants or expects the taxpayers to be funding their operation, they should have the same obligation. And they don't want any of that. They want to be able to select and choose. And we know that that's not fair, and it certainly doesn't guarantee choice to those parents. But I want to pick up on what you were saying, because, you know, the traditional model probably is going to change anyway, and we need to look at that. I think parents, we all want choice. You know, we drive up to the Burger King, we want a choice of how we want the hamburger made. I think a lot of people want choice in the kinds of school opportunities their kids have. And we can do a lot of creative and innovative things within the public school setting. And I know you've done an awful lot of good work in that area. Charter schools can be another way that we do that, although
charter
the law we have in this state, I think, is in huge need of some reform itself. But these are options within the public school setting without needing to go to a voucher program.
Well, that's exactly my point. The whole key issue for me is that the internal infrastructure is the problem here, and that whether we talk about, and I've had, you were at the conference with the various schools. One was a charter, one was a school within a school, one was a voucher school. The external infrastructure is really not the key here. It is the internal infrastructure that needs to be changed. It's over 100 years old, and it's unfortunately, we have people who are making decisions in the decision-making process all the way up from the Department of Ed and the legislators all the way down who are in the same thinking, in the same box mentality, and it's very difficult for them to get outside of the box. I took several legislators this week up to New York to see one of our schools, and I can't tell you how I actually couldn't get one out of the building. His mindset was that he was going to not, he saw how loose the environment was, and he had his mindset that this was not an educational environment for students, until three ninth graders challenged him to a debate to which he had, for some questions, no answers. There, he found that their depth of information and knowledge was absolutely extraordinary. So what I'm trying to show here is that, you know, the vouchers, the charters, this is not the answer. It's the internal infrastructure that must change, and the vouchers, certainly I agree with you, is not the answer here.
And I would say one other thing, too, and I think this disturbs me a lot when I hear state officials saying this, and they seem to enjoy saying it often, which is that, you know, this debate around vouchers and so forth is not about the system, the public school system. It's about the children. Well, I think we're all concerned about kids and the options they have, but I would argue that we should be concerned about the system. And I agree with you, we need to look at changing the system and allowing more choice and then opening up some options and so forth. But fundamentally, what's important about the public education system is that it guarantees access to every student.
That's the problem.
The danger with vouchers is we would have this sort of balkanization. We'd go back to where we were in this state before Thaddeus Stevens stood up on the floor of the state legislature and gave his famous speech that defended the Common School Act and opened up public education to everybody. We would have certain religious groups educating their own kids, and a lot of children falling through the cracks and not educated at all. And that's the value of a public education system, is that we ensure that everybody has hopefully a quality education and is prepared to move out. We certainly don't object to parents having the right to send their kids to a religious school if they want to. That's not the issue. The issue is whether the taxpayers should be asked to pay for that, and we think.
And I think what has happened is that you've alluded to is the fact that we now, because of public education, everyone is a part of the process.
Right.
And you have from the wealthiest to the poor, from the handicapped to the most accelerated students, all from every different neighborhood participating in the classroom experience. And with that comes many, many, many other kinds of issues that we hadn't addressed before. Mm-hmm. And what we would like to think, and I don't know how you feel about this, but we know that from our research and from our experience is that the smaller the schools are, and I don't mean 12 and 14 students, which I find is there is actually a school in this state with 12 students, but somewhere hovering around 300 students, when you have that kind of a manageable system, many of the problems that we've been having in our schools, both in the state of Pennsylvania and nationwide, tend to be alleviated. And we need to really rethink and relook at what we've done in terms of consolidation and making these huge monstrosities a museum for our students.
I couldn't agree more. We went through that wave back in the 60s, bigger is better. And clearly some schools need maybe at that time needed to be a little larger to have some more resources. But when you put hundreds and hundreds of students under one roof, it's hard. I think just common sense tells you that you lose something in that process, and you lose connection to students, and you lose the ability to really reach everybody.
What's the future for public education?
Well, I actually think it's very strong. I mean, one of the things that this whole debate, or really around vouchers and a lot of other questions that have been swirling, I think it forces all of us to speak more openly about the value of public education, something that perhaps was taken for granted for too long. Virtually everybody probably who's listening to your program has some direct connection to public schools, or either went there or have children who went there. And I would challenge people when they question the quality of public education, and there are public schools that need a lot of help, no question about that, but to spend some time in them and to talk to students who attend those programs, because I think they would be shocked at the level and the quality of learning that's going on. I mean, the data is very, very clear about this. We have more and more students taking more challenging courses, learning things today in high school that clearly were college-level courses just even 20-some years ago when I was in college. And yet that word doesn't get out very well, and I think most people believe the cynics who like to beat up on public education. And I see those of us who care a lot about public schools and the importance of them, I think a lot of people are speaking out more actively now, and that's going to be critical in the long run.
Well, you have certainly informed us a great deal on many of the issues involving our children, and I greatly appreciate your being with us today.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
You've been listening to Children Come First, and we've had Tom Gensel on, who is the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. If you'd like additional information from Tom, you may reach him at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can go to the website at www.psba.org. That's www.psba.org. If you'd like any information about our program, or you'd like to suggest a guest, please call us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS, or email us at ProKIDS, ProKIDS, at rlc.net. That's ProKIDS at rlc.net. And join us again next week when we'll have another interesting guest talking about our children and the things that we can do for him or her. Have a great week, and join us again next week. Thank you. Come First, and we're here every week. We'd like to introduce today our special guest. As you know, we're always inquiring about children and their needs, and this one is a little twist on our usual topics, and today we're going to be speaking with Tom Gensel. Tom is the Assistant Executive Director of all things, the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Daria.
Tom, we're going to talk today about this elusive entity called a school board. So I'm hoping you're going to be able to help us, because sometimes I'm not sure that I can figure out what exactly the function of each level of education is. So I'm hoping you're going to help us on this level.
Happy to try.
How long have you been with the School Board Association?
Almost 20 years. This summer it'll be 20 years.
You've been with the School Boards Association for 20 years.
I know. Honestly, it does not seem possible. Time really does fly, I guess, when you enjoy what you're doing.
Wow. And you look young for your age, then.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Tom, let's talk a little bit about the functions of school boards. What is the function of the association itself? Let's start with that.
Well, we are a private nonprofit organization. We're not related to state government. So we are an organization that really consists of the local school boards throughout the state. They voluntarily join our organization, and we in turn provide information, publications, various services, including management services and insurance services, customized workshops, as well as the advocacy work that we do at the state and federal levels. That's actually the area that I'm responsible for.
And what do you advocate for?
Well, really, we see our role as being representing the public's interest in this process. Board members are elected locally. They are the public's representative in this process for setting policy and overseeing the operation of schools. And those local board members establish a platform and adopt positions that they think are needed to improve public education. And I guess, Daria, I would draw a distinction between our organization and many of the others that do good work in the education system, but whose function is really quite different. When we advocate at the state level, for example, before the General Assembly, it's not for the personal benefit of our members. We're not advocating new benefits for them. We're advocating legislation that they think be needed to help improve education. And, for example, funding and changing the system for funding special education is one of our big issues right now. So that's not something that benefits our members personally, but it's something that they think is important to improve education.
All right. Now let's take a look at school boards themselves. What is the function of a school board? There are so many hierarchies in the educational process that I can't. Can you relate it to business?
Sure.
In any way?
Well, in a way, the school board is the board of directors. Literally, that's what it's called in the school code of the school district. Their responsibility. All but one of the 501 school boards in the state are elected. Philadelphia is the one exception, and there the board is appointed by the mayor. But in all the other districts, it's an elected board of the community, and their job really is to establish policy and oversee the operation of the schools in their district. Obviously, much of what public schools do is regulated in some way by the state or federal governments or various court decisions, but there's still a lot of room for local decision-making and local control, and in that role, the board members are the elected representatives of the community. And I would add that they are not compensated. I think one of the real wonderful things about our system of governance is that we have these 4,500 local officials, nine on each of 501 school boards, who serve without pay and who devote enormous amount of time and energy to providing that direction for public schools. It's not an easy job, obviously, but it's, I think, a great example of community service.
All right. Now, the school board itself, so we have I'm going to assume an ideal here. We have the superintendent who works on the day-to-day operations of the district and deals with litigation and, you know, the community and things of that nature. and I'm assuming oversees hiring and firing of personnel. What function does the school board have?
First of all, the board, of course, hires the superintendent. Probably the most single most important thing that a board does is to hire the right educational leader. The superintendent, by the way, is obviously not a voting member of the board, but is a member of the board by law. Is kind of considered the 10th non-voting member of the board. So it's an active partner with the school board in managing the district. The district has a number of enumerated duties. It has to approve textbooks. It actually does the official hiring of teachers, although in most districts the screening and recruitment and so forth, the recommendations come from the administration. They adopt a budget, set the tax levies, and provide policy direction. One of the roles of a school board is to enact policy, which is kind of the equivalent of a school law, if you will, like that directs how things would be done in a school district. And those policies then in turn are implemented by the administrators.
Now, I have a question to ask only because I've been in business for many years. And I'm sort of playing the devil's advocate here. You'll have to excuse me. But you said that school boards hire teachers. Now, I've been on boards, and I've been, not school boards, but I've been on business boards, and I have a board myself. And our board would not ever be involved in the hiring of personnel. Why are school boards hiring teachers?
On one level, I guess the answer is because the school code requires that, but also because there is a form of accountability back to the public. I mean, unlike a corporate board, we're talking about spending tax dollars. Now, I think the bigger issue that you're raising, though, is at what level of detail should a school board be operating? School districts tend to be fairly large operations in many communities in this state, particularly in rural areas. The school district is one of the largest employers in the area. So it would probably not be possible or certainly appropriate for a school board to be micromanaging all the daily operations of a district. That's why you hire good administrators, you establish policy and expectations, and you hold them accountable for implementing it. One of the most important duties, I think, of a school board is to say, as representatives of the public in the community, the parents, the taxpayers, business interests, and others, here's the direction we want to move this school district, and to be, if you will, looking beyond the dashboard down the road and trying to move the district in that direction. So they have responsibility for making sure that the laws are being complied with, that the programs are being implemented, procedures are being followed. But their duties, obviously, are not to do those things themselves. They're not expected to. They are volunteers, but they have responsibility for ensuring that those things all happen.
Well, I guess I have to give you a little bit of impetus, information on why I asked you that question, and that was that I noticed that the new regulations that were, I believe, put out last year were directly relational to something called nepotism, which, frankly, I haven't heard in a very long time. I was working out of Virginia for a long time and have come back to Pennsylvania. And when I went around to the different school boards and observed school board meetings, I noted that I observed it, for example, in one school district where they were hiring teachers, and they had three applications, and I noted that one of them had tremendous qualifications and was from another state. And yet they hired the person who was in their own backyard and, frankly speaking, was related to one of the school board members. So it left an impression on me, and I considered this kind of a micromanaging that probably is something that might be addressed in terms of what school boards do. And am I incorrect in that assumption?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say as a general rule, and I get around to many of the districts in the state, that boards, you know, hire their own relatives. I mean, as a matter of fact, in most districts, the process for reviewing and screening applicants, as I, you know, indicated before, comes through the administrators. But let me just say a couple other things. One is that a lot of districts, and you know, I've lived in some of these areas, are very small rural areas, and the issue of nepotism is kind of an interesting one, because if you said you couldn't hire a relative of a board member, you know, I've literally lived in towns where I think everybody was related to each other. It'd be very difficult to untangle that. The other is that when we look at new teachers, for example, what we found, and we've surveyed school districts on this subject, we find that oftentimes they do tend to be more comfortable with local people, if you will, and often it's because these are teachers who have done their student teaching there that are known to them. It's a known quantity. I think the point is well made, and we have talked with our members about looking at casting the net widely and bringing in folks to teaching positions who come from a variety of schools, not just the nearby state school, but perhaps some private colleges, and so that you build a teaching force that reflects sort of a range of philosophies, if you will, not just the philosophy of the faculty at the college down the street. And I think a lot of districts try to do that, but how they do it, again, and the procedures they go through is really a matter of local control. There really isn't much state regulation about how a district hires teacher. We have, as I think every state does, we have requirements that teachers in the public schools hold state certificates, and a state certificate is it's really a declaration that that individual is qualified to teach. So we've already gotten past the issue of whether or not the person is qualified. If they hold the certificate, they're considered qualified. It's up to the district to say who's the best fit for our program. And sometimes it's not necessarily the teacher that had the straight A's in college. I mean, if you look at a new teacher or a student teacher who is very effective in the classroom but had a B average in college, sometimes that can be more important if they're able to reach the students and actually help them to learn.
Well, you had addressed the next question that I was about to ask you, which was that, you know, when you tend to hire locally, the bank of information, new information that's coming in, and the kinds of diversity that we're looking for and new ideas doesn't always exist when you hire people locally. It's a good policy, and, you know, we also need to expand our horizons as well.
Yeah, I might say, just on that point, you know, I think this is probably human nature as much as anything else, but when we've asked the question, not just of school board members, by the way, this is a question we asked of superintendents as well and school administrators. Which colleges do the best job of preparing new teachers? Inevitably, what we saw was they primarily listed the nearby schools. And when we looked into that a little further, what we found was those were the colleges they knew best. They worked with the education faculty at those schools. They had the student teachers that came out of those programs, and they had a comfort level with them. So it's kind of understandable how people would have that frame of reference, but I think the point's well made. Districts have large pools of applications in this state for teachers, which is not a luxury that some other states have right now. California is pretty much at a point, I think, of just putting a warm body in the classroom.
In Florida as well.
Pennsylvania, we have a larger pool, and certainly, without getting into the whole teacher salary issue, I'll just say the salaries are not a problem. We know that people want to go into the classroom. So districts have the ability now to pick and choose perhaps a little more than they might have at one time.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Tom Gensel. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Tom is the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. We're talking about school boards and their function. If you'd like information from Tom or the School Boards Association, you may call them at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can call us here at Children Come First at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PRO-KIDS. Now, Tom, why do we need people who don't have education backgrounds, who have basically gone through school themselves and have either gone into business or retired or done other things on school boards? Why do we need those kinds of people?
That's actually, I think, a great question, and it really gets to the heart of what school boards are all about. I think the answer, in a sentence or two is that we want a cross-section of the community making policy. That's the local ownership in the education process. We hire education experts to be our administrators and our teachers and to actually deliver the educational program. But the policy setting really needs to come from the community, which is paying for this after all. So a school board that includes some parents, some business officials, some blue-collar workers, folks, retirees, people who don't have kids in school, a good cross-section of the community, when they can act as representatives of the public and say, here's the priority, here's the programs we're going to fund, here's the budget we're going to adopt, they can speak a little bit more for the community that again, is supporting the decision.
So you are now not a governmental agency. You are a nonprofit agency, the Pennsylvania School Boards Association.
Nonprofit association, that's right.
And you give information to school boards.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you have a source for disseminating that information?
Yeah, actually, we produce a number of publications, a weekly magazine that contains a lot of reports on what's happening in Harrisburg and around the country, a bi-monthly magazine, other specialized newsletters. I would also say we have a website that we're very proud of, and we encourage all of your listeners to visit. That's www.psba.org. That would also, I think, give you a flavor of a number of the things we do. We also provide, and I would want to make sure I emphasize this, an awful lot of in-service programs for our members, because we recognize really two things. One, that our members are generally not experts in education, although we do have some, obviously. Most of them don't have a background in education or in budgeting and finance and a lot of the other areas that school boards deal with. So they attend our programs, and we're very proud of the high level of participation and really the high quality of the programs we put on. The other thing we know, and this is important to point out, Daria, is that there's a high level of turnover on school boards. The average school director in this state serves only about 4 years, or about one term. And I don't know about you, but that's almost scary to me, because there's a lot of upheaval that we see through this process, and it's very difficult to sustain a long-term vision for an organization, a school district, or any group where you have that kind of turnover on boards.
Are you suggesting that they stay in for longer periods?
Well, what I'm saying is that back in the late 70s, the law was changed. We used to have 6-year term for board members, and what that meant was every 2 years, every odd-numbered year, three members of a school board would be up for election. And if there was turnover, it tended to happen in not quite as dramatic a way. Or, you know, you certainly rarely saw a majority of the board sort of just shifting. We changed to a 4-year term, and now it's a 5-4 rotation. Every other year, either 5 or 4 seats are up. And in some cases, with vacancies to be filled and so forth, we've seen 6, 7, 8 seats up in one election. And I certainly think it's important that, you know, if the public doesn't want these people on a school board, that they're able to replace them. All I'm saying is that when you have these large turnovers and you see the average length of service on a board, that's really the bigger issue as far as I'm concerned. The average length of service is down to around 4 years. Many of our members, as we do our training programs and talk with them, will say that, you know, if you're just elected to a school board, it takes you a year or two before you're really pretty comfortable with the terms and, you know, the requirements of law and so forth. It's a complex business. And when the average person's out of office after 4 years, we're always starting over with a new group. That's why I think the in-service programs, the publications, the resources we make available to school districts are so important, because they need to learn as much as they can as quickly as they can.
Isn't there a way to make it so that it's, you know, only... Well, let's see, 9 divided by 4. Isn't it possible for every year only to have 2?
Well, this gets into a larger area of law, which is that the election laws in this state have always put local elections, not just school districts, but municipal and county elections, in the odd-numbered years. And state-related offices, the General Assembly and governor and treasurer and auditor general, for example, in the even-numbered years. So it would be kind of a huge mountain to move. And I don't know if there's an easy answer to it, but I think people need to understand that we're dealing with that issue as well. And I can also say that there's really a very high level of commitment and quality that we see on local boards. People run for school boards. You'll run into people occasionally that ran because they have one single issue kind of thing that was bothering them. But most people run because they really have a genuine concern about the schools in their community. They want to do the right thing, and they volunteer. They're not paid for it, but they step forward. And I think everything we can do to make that job easier for them and to give them the information they need is helpful.
Now, what kinds of services do you give to school boards? You do in-service training. Mm-hmm. You have media support. You were talking earlier about changing legislation. Now, I know from having spoken to legislators and to, especially to legislators, that they are inundated by all the special interest groups that come and speak to them about all the different kinds of... as a matter of fact, I was on the phone with one this morning who said his head was spinning because there were all these legislative issues to vote on this week, and he just couldn't make up his mind. You know, he'd had to delve into some in-depth, and they are just inundated with reports and, you know, special interest group and lobbyists and et cetera. How do you fare in all of this?
Well, you know, I go back, first of all, to what I was saying before. We are not like many of the other groups that lobby, and I don't mean to demean them at all. They all have a role to play, but we're not up there lobbying on behalf of school board members, in other words, to enhance them. But our agenda is really driven by these volunteers on boards who representing their community, saying here are the laws that we think need to be changed to improve public education. And I think most legislators understand that. We don't have, for example, the School Boards Association does not have a political action committee. We don't endorse candidates. My staff and I do not wine and dine legislators. We don't take them out to dinner and buy them drinks. We don't do that kind of thing. Our lobbying is strictly informational lobbying, and I think where we've been very effective is establishing ourselves as a good, reliable, fairly impartial source of information that people can count on. We provide a lot of data to legislators at their request, and we comment on bills that are coming up to help them understand the effect locally. The other major thing we do, and again, have become pretty effective at this, is to provide the means for our local members, the officials sitting on school boards, to actually be talking to and working with legislators. And that's really critical when you think about it, because you have these local elected officials on school boards talking with state elected officials who are trying to get their decisions about policy and direction for education in sync, so that we're all pulling in the same direction. And that's really critical, and I think we've been pretty effective at doing that.
How are you funded?
We're funded by the school district, so they pay dues to us for kind of part of our budget. And the services that we provide, for example, the in-service programs I was talking about, we do work with school districts on, for example, on policy service, helping them to write their policies. Those kinds of services we charge the districts that actually use them, so the ones that are interested in having PSBA help them catalog and write their policies and help them update policies as new laws and court decisions come out, which is one of the things we've done for years, would pay for that service. But it's a voluntary membership organization, and we're very proud of the fact that we've had virtually 100% membership, you know, throughout really all of our existence.
So now comes to the critical point of you've got 15 school districts, school boards, who are vying for your attention for you to go to legislators. And each one of them has a different issue on their agenda, and some of them may be contradictory. How do you pick which one you which position you take?
Yeah, it's a very diverse state. I spend a lot of time on the road, and I'm often reminded of that. We have some of the very wealthiest communities in the entire country within our state, and some of the very, very poorest in the largest cities and very rural areas. We started something over 15 years ago, almost 16 years ago now, called Legislative Action Program, and the whole point of it was to, after we've adopted our platform, which all boards participate in, and we have probably 100 items in that platform talking about things like funding and curriculum and collective bargaining and, you know, school construction, you name it. So we have positions that the boards themselves adopt. That's the one part of the answer to your question. We're guided by our own members' positions. We certainly don't make them up here. But the other thing we've done for the last 16 years is we go back out on the road and we go to county level meetings with board members and we say, look, here's the entire platform you've just adopted. Give us some input on what you think are the top two or three most important issues that we should really focus our efforts primarily on. And I remember when we started that 16 years ago, some people said, you know, you guys are crazy because you're going to have the rural districts at the throat of the urban districts and vice versa because everybody's going to have different priorities. Has never happened, never once. As a matter of fact, what we've seen year after year after year is a real consensus that we're able to build through all these discussions. And, of course, it takes a lot of time and a lot of listening and getting people to kind of understand the options. But what we've done is we've managed to come to consensus and have boards across this state working together on a lot of things. And I think with some success, we had, for example, legislation that revised the collective bargaining law in this state that we really took the lead on getting passed a number of years ago, changes in sabbatical leave and tenure law, changes in funding and so forth that our members really came together on and we're working very closely together and often with other organizations too.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here every Tuesday. Today we're here with Tom Gensel. He is the Assistant Executive Director of the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. If you'd like to reach him, you can phone him at 717-774-2331. That's 717-774-2331. Or you can reach him on the website. You can reach the website at www.psba.org. That stands for Pennsylvania, I'm sure, School Boards Association. www.psba.org. Or if you'd like to reach us with any questions or copies of our programs, you may call us toll-free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Or you may email us at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids, PROKIDS, at rlc.net. We're going to take a few minutes here, and we're going to acknowledge our sponsors. And we'll be back for our second half hour with Tom Gensel talking about school boards, their functions, and where we go from here for the 21st century. So please join us for our second half hour. Again, if you'd like to call us, it's 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. And we'll be back in a few moments.